Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, January 13th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Bids are in, but work is far from done. Communities buy in New Look Arena among reasons for optimism. From Champaign. 5 years ago, Visit Champaign County President Jane DeLuce received a disheartening call. The state boys basketball tournament would not be returning to Champaign after 20 years in Peoria. IHSA Assistant Executive Director Matt Troia told her just before the decision would be made public. It was very disappointing, to say the least. There were questions where maybe you wished in hindsight that maybe we had done some things differently. In retrospect, the Champaign bid had plenty working against it. The state tournament left Champaign for Peoria in 1996, giving Carver Arena home field advantage, and State Farm Center was under construction while it was being pitched as the new site for the tournament. Champaign's financial bid also reportedly fell short of Peoria's, and for Duluth, a looming question hung over the bidding process. I don't know, even though they put the bid out, were they really ready to look at moving? I don't have the scientific data that says yes, they wanted to move, or no, they didn't, but they were just thinking about it. This time, though, circumstances have changed. For one, State Farm Center is finished and functional. When we did a site visit 5 years ago, Duluth said, we were in the middle of a dust bowl. We were looking at renderings. This is what we could be. While we knew where was some legacy type of space, and there would be an Orange Crush type of space, those weren't even all determined by that point. So you're going, we're going to have this space, and there's a boiler room here right now. The main difference that may cause the IHSA to give more consideration to switching locations, though, is the change to the tournament's format. In 2021, all four classes will play their semifinal and championship games on the same weekend rather than the current format where Class 1A and 2A are played the weekend before Class 3A and 4A. It's an interesting dynamic because we're providing a little twist to the format of the event, IHSA Executive Director Craig Anderson said. So while, yeah, we're familiar with how it's played out in Peoria heading into next year, things are going to be different. So it sparks our interest even here to see if Peoria has provided some insight as to how they see things changing potentially. One of the things that we'd like to see with this modification of a single weekend tournament is that it might rejuvenate the tournament and we'll have more fans. The three tournaments that the winning bidder will host will be held March 11th through 13th, 2021, March 10th through 12th, 2022, and March 9th through 11th, 2023. Duluth and U of I Associate Athletic Director Jason Lerner personally handed Champaign's bid for the tournament to Anderson on Thursday, a day before Friday's deadline. And this time, Duluth is feeling better about Champaign's chances. I felt good about the bid last time. I feel great about the bid today. I feel much more about the fact that they want to consider all of the opportunities for where they want to host it. The finances of the bid are still unknown, and Duluth was tight-lipped because she didn't want to play Champaign's hand for Peoria to see. Last time, Champaign's bid totaled $750,000, comprising $240,000 from local governments and $510,000 from businesses. At the time, Scott Adrian, an IHSA board member and former principal of Moroa Foresight, said there was a significant difference between the bids, both financially and in what they were able to offer. Adrian, who is still on the board and is now principal at Dunlap, said at the time that the board had to run the IHSA like a business. While the board will have the final say, they're not necessarily the biggest influencers in the decision. Anderson, who wasn't involved in the process last time, said after visits to the two locations, IHSA staff will likely make a decision that they'll present to the board. We'll provide a basis for why we're recommending one venue over another and others. Then the board will decide on it. In 2015, Duluth said the fundraising effort from the State Farm Center bid was grassroots. While she didn't get into finances, Deluce said many more people are involved with the bid this time than in 2015, when she said only a handful were. Being the one-weekend format, everybody is all in. That's easier on State Farm Center from a scheduling standpoint to always reserve one weekend instead of two weekends. It's easier if we want to bring in outside groups, be that might showcase what they do. In general, people are like, yeah, this is great. The bids are in now, but that doesn't mean the work is over. Anderson and members of his staff will plan visits to both Champaign and Peoria. Lerner, who co-chaired the bid with Deluce, wouldn't give details of what they'd show IHSA officials, but he seems intent on wowing them. I think some of the things that when you walk into the building are just obvious, but there's other components of the building that we will certainly showcase. And there are certain aspects of what the building can do and the technology that the building has that will really be a benefit for us. Price gouging from area hotels was a popular reason given for the move to Peoria in 1996 after a 77-year run on the U of I campus. And after conversations with local hotels, Deluce is confident that won't be an issue this time around when there will be several hundred more rooms available. In the end, though, she doesn't think that was the reason for the departure in the first place. I think what happened at that point was two things. One, the Peoria folks did a good job of putting together a financial package that involved private support that hadn't really been done in high school or many other sports tournaments. And a lot of things have changed with that in bringing any kind of those tournaments to a community. And the other thing is that I think our community got complacent. I think that we took it for granted that we had the tournament every year and we never thought that it would leave. And so you've got a new entity that comes in and says, hey, we're going to do this for you and we're going to do that for you. And we lost sight of that. We rested on our laurels and we got a little complacent. We've learned our lessons and that won't happen again. An article by Tom Kasich, more than just students propelling local Dems in the elections. Here's a misconception in the community that Champaign-Urbana's switch from marginally Republican to solidly Democratic is only because of supposedly great numbers of University of Illinois students turning out in local elections and swamping the votes of townies. Not so. The evolution in partisanship has been going on for decades. The last Republican presidential candidate to win the city of Champaign was Ronald Reagan in 1984. The last GOP presidential candidate to win Urbana was Reagan in 1980. But it has accelerated since 2000 and reached its zenith, or nadir, in the last two elections. That's when, in 2016, Donald Trump got just 11,621 votes in Champaign-Urbana, 25% of the vote, or about 5,000 fewer than George W. Bush posted in CU in 2004, and about 8,500 fewer than Reagan in 1984. And in 2018, the Republican losses extended to unprecedented defeats in every countywide race, from sheriff to county executive. The strongest GOP showing was by Gordy Holton, the Republican candidate for county executive, who ended up with 47% of the vote. But he and other Republican candidates were leveled in Champaign-Urbana. Holton won just 5 of the 62 precincts in Champaign-Urbana. This was far more than a big campus turnout overwhelming the rest of the town. Yet that perception persists on social media and elsewhere. I agree that the anti-Trump movement certainly contributed to the voting, but in my mind, the single biggest factor in deciding the countywide offices was the voting of temporary residents in the form of U of I students, was the emailed message I got from a reader last month in response to a column about whether the local Republican Party could recover from the 2016 and 2018 election debacles. And looking at the Rodney Davis-Betsy Laudrigan congressional race, results in particular, if my memory serves me correctly, Laudrigan only won 3 of 18 counties in the district, and all 3 were home to universities, the reader continued. The Democratic Party did a tremendous job in using fear of Trump to recruit young people on college campuses. I personally believe that unless a student establishes year-round residency in a county, that they should be required to vote in their actual county of legal full-time residence. While some students may stay in Champaign County after graduation, the vast majority move on, leaving the citizens who actually live their lives here with office holders, not the choice of a majority of those citizens. College students have the right to vote here. That has been established by state law and court rulings. But that is irrelevant to this issue. It's not just the college students who are voting against Republicans in Champaign-Urbana. Trump lost every single precinct in Champaign-Urbana in 2016, from the campus area to the most traditionally Republican precincts in southwest Champaign, such as City of Champaign 38, generally south of Windsor Road and west of Mattis Avenue, where Trump was defeated by Hillary Clinton 721 to 430. 4 years earlier in the same precinct, Mitt Romney defeated Barack Obama 557 to 548. Trump's unpopularity that year affected the rest of the GOP ticket in Champaign-Urbana. Incumbent U.S. Senator Mark Kirk also failed to carry a single local precinct. Republican State Comptroller candidate Leslie Munger won just five of the 62 precincts. In 2018, the Republican rout continued. Bruce Rauner, running for a second term as governor, lost every precinct in Champaign-Urbana. So did the GOP candidates for Secretary of State, State Comptroller, State Treasurer, and Congress. Erica Harrell, the Republican nominee for Attorney General and a Champaign County native, won five urban precincts. And among the five Republican countywide candidates in 2018, they won just seven CU precincts out of possible total of 310. As bad as things were for Republicans in Champaign-Urbana, they were much better in most of the rest of the county. Trump, for example, won 46 of the 56 precincts outside the city. And in 2018, Harrell won all but three of the precincts outside of the city. But most of the county's voters live in Champaign-Urbana, a community, not just U of I students, that has become increasingly Democratic, particularly under Trump. Although 13 Democratic presidential candidates have filed to be listed on Illinois' March 17th primary election ballot, fewer than half are running delegate slates in East Central Illinois. In the 13th congressional district that includes Champaign-Urbana, 22 delegates representing five presidential contenders are listed. The local delegate candidates and their candidate affiliations are Mark Robert Maddock for Joe Biden, Teresa Brennan and Kalasi Messe, and Geraldo Romero for Andrew Yang, Mike Friedrichs, Elizabeth Warren, Carol Ammons and Alan Axelrod, and Brian Wylans for Bernie Sanders, and Carol McLean and John Berge and Ann Hylas for Amy Klobuchar. In the 15th congressional district that includes Danville, Rantoul, Tuscola, and other parts of southeastern Illinois, nine delegates representing three presidential contenders are listed, and they include Jermaine Light for Sanders and Cynthia Cunningham, Samuel Reese, and Rachel Smith Bolton for Warren. Among the presidential candidates who don't have delegate slates in either congressional district are Pete Buttigieg, Michael Bloomberg, Tom Steyer, Cory Booker, and Tulsi Gabbard. And from Urbana, no one knowledgeable in Treasurer's office. Prussing's replacement likely won't be in place until at least February. A forensic accountant hired by Champaign County Executive Darlene Klopel urged the county treasurer's office in late December to stop the bleeding, according to a summary of the accountant's progress notes posted for county board members. Klopel said she hired the consulting CPA from the firm of Clifton Larson Allen to work for a month this past December to help Treasurer Laurel Prussing's office catch up on reconciling county bank accounts for January through October 2019, with the understanding that Prussing's office would learn the process and complete the work for the rest of the year. A summary of the work done by the CPA for the week ending December 28, 2019, referred to a discussion with the Treasurer's Office about the bank account reconciliation process. Quote, the Treasurer's Office responded that they don't know how to record or post transactions or have knowledge of what the bank reconciliation process is, unquote. When asked if they are currently posting or recording any transactions or adjustments or doing anything regarding the bank accounts, was told no. It goes on to state, I strongly advise them to stop the bleeding and in 2020 to start immediately processing any bank transactions, adjustments, as well as keep any documentation as it relates to each of the bank accounts. In a memo to the county board dated January 7th, Klopel said the consulting CPA spent 140 hours at a cost of $20,000, but was unable to complete the treasurer's office work because of missing information. Currently, there is no one knowledgeable in the treasurer's office to finish 2019 reconciliations and start with January 2020. Prussing, a Democrat-elected treasurer in November 2018, recently resigned effective January 31st. While she hadn't seen the summary of the Clifton-Larson-Allen notes as of Friday, Prussing said more than 99% of the work done by her office is connected to property taxes, while bank account reconciliations make up a fraction of 1%. It's a small thing compared to the total responsibilities of this office, she said. Obviously, it has to be done right, but it's not a crisis. Also in the summary of Clifton Larson Allen notes for the week ending December 14th, and listed under additional issues and concerns, was this. Transactions not posted, posted incorrectly, and posted in other months. For the week ending December 21st, the CPA noted that some October bank statements were still missing. The note goes on to state, for January, bank reconciliations worked through 7 of the 10 accounts, and only 2 are complete. The other 5 of the 7 have very large variances. County Board Chairman Geraldo Rosales said he read the single-page summary of the CPA's notes and pronounced it thin. It wasn't what I expected, he said. We did ask Darlene Klopel to reproduce it. It had no figures. It had no worthwhile information to go on to move forward. Rosales said what he had been expecting was more detail on what was wrong and how far behind the treasurer's office was. Klopel has outlined a plan to move forward in her memo to the county board. The county auditor's office has offered a staff person on an emergency temporary basis to work overtime on the 2019 bank account reconciliations to be paid from the treasurer's budget. County Auditor George Danos will also train new staff in the treasurer's office on how to do posting and reconciliations going forward, and the Tazewell County Treasurer will also provide training on the treasurer's use of the DevNet property tax software. Rosales will formally announce the upcoming treasurer vacancy at a county board committee meeting on Tuesday, which will start the process for replacing Prussing at least temporarily. The remainder of Prussing's 4-year term will be up for election November 3rd. It will be at least later in February and possibly in March until a replacement can be appointed and confirmed. Prussing's replacement must be a Democrat, but it must also be somebody who is qualified. We're in a pickle where the office is hemorrhaging, and we need somebody who is seriously going to do the work and crank out the numbers, not a political hire. And from the sports page, second chance, Illini only behind Michigan State in league standings from Champaign. Early Big Ten play has done Illinois men's basketball no favors the past 2 seasons. Brad Underwood's first year as coach saw the Illini drop their first 8 conference games before finally getting that first win in late January. Last season wasn't much better. An 0-5 start in the Big Ten gave way to another bottom 4 of the conference finish. That made Saturday's 54-51 victory against Rutgers in front of an announced State Farm Center crowd of 11,000 rather momentous. The 3-point victory, after all, pushed Illinois into sole possession of second place in the conference behind the league-leading Michigan State. It's a great feeling knowing the hard work's paying off, Illinois sophomore guard Ayo Dunsmuth said, but we're not satisfied. At the beginning of the season, we knew what we were capable of, and we still know what we're capable of. We want more. We want to keep striving to get better and better and be the best team in the league. We've got a bye week this week, no game, so a lot of time to get better, a lot of time to clean up some of the things we didn't necessarily do right, and things that can help us be the best team we can be. What Illinois didn't necessarily do right Saturday against Rutgers is mostly limited to the offensive end. The Illini ultimately shot 28.6% from the field, but that took a Herculean effort down the stretch after shooting 19.4% in the first half and missing all seven of their three-point attempts. So it might behoove Illinois to use the next 6 days before it hosts Northwestern on January 18th to work out some offensive kinks. Defensively, the Illini can't really complain. They held Rutgers to 33% shooting overall from the field and did so without fouling, giving the Scarlet Knights attempted just 8 free throws. We put a big box on the court around the lane, Underwood said. We worked all the last 2 days on trying to keep them out of the box. It's guys paying attention to the scouting report, guys taking pride in it. When you shoot 29%, you better find a way to win. That's why I was ecstatic in the locker room. I was a really happy basketball coach on Saturday that we could find a way to win a game like that. Underwood had some concerns about how his team might play against Rutgers following last Wednesday's at Wisconsin. Beating the Badgers snapped a 15-game losing streak to the Illini's Northern Conference rival. Emotions were running high, particularly since Illinois pulled off that road victory in comeback fashion. You worry about the next step, and that's growing through those things and getting yourself back up to that level again. I'm happy with the growth of our program when you shoot 29% and win. They're not all going to be pretty. It's a compliment to our players and our coaching staff, the job we're doing defensively. Understand an ugly win is much better than a pretty loss when you look at the stat sheets. It's why we play this is to figure out ways to win. We've been striving and striving to win games when the ball doesn't go in. You have to figure out how to do that. Illinois again put the ball in Dunsmuth's hands to close out another comeback victory. The 6'5" sophomore guard scored the Illini's final 8 points and finished with a game high of 18. He's terrific, Rutgers coach Steve Pikkel said of Dunsmuth. He's an elite athlete. Going right, he's a hard guy to stop, and he can make big shots for them. The Scarlet Knights didn't make enough big shots of their own. Redshirt junior guard Jacob Young hit 4 three-pointers and led Rutgers with 16 points, but the misses, especially from three-point range, piled up for the Scarlet Knights just as quickly as they did for the Illini. I like to drive it, Pikkel said. I like to get to the free throw line. I didn't like our rebounding. We need to be plus on them. I didn't like a lot of things. You've got to play better basketball on the road against a really good team, a well-coached team. You've got to play better on the road to win in this league. The Illini successfully defended their home court for the third time in Big Ten play and second in less than a week, has them at least in charge of their own destiny in conference play with 14 games left before the Big Ten tournament. That's exactly why it means nothing, Underwood said about his team currently sitting in second in the conference standings. We've got two-thirds of the season left. We've got 14 games. The next one that's on our schedule is going to be just as hard as this one. I guess maybe you could say we haven't dug a hole starting 0-2 in December. We've given ourselves a fighting chance, but I don't look at standings. It's the next game. It's the next practice. You guys are going to hear me say that a bunch. There's no other way to look at it. We're only as good as our next game and our next practice. We're fighting and we're doing the right things. At the end, they'll tally them up and we'll see where we're at. And from Lauren Tate, shooting numbers still a big concern despite win streak. Nobody said it had to be pretty, or as Brad Underwood expressed it, an ugly win is better than a pretty loss. Underwood's hard-pressured Illini emerged with bruises, contusions, and a wide smile in taking a 54-51 basketball scrum from equally physical Rutgers at State Farm Center on Saturday. Give thanks to a 17-rebound effort by Kofi Cockburn, 4 second-half baskets by senior sub Andres Velez when no one else could score, and the last 8 points from Io Desmoux on 6 clutch free throws and a Rutgers goaltend. Desmoux is once again drawing NBA interest with 18 or more points in the 5 of his last 6 games. Thus did Illinois, now 4-2 in league play, find itself trailing only Michigan State in the Big Ten standings after advancing an incredible home record that shows just 5 losses in 35 conference games going into Sunday. Ah, the home court. What other explanation could you give for the way Indiana slapped around number 11 Ohio State on Saturday? Imagine just 5 road losses in 34 showdowns involving mostly comparable defense-oriented teams. But this Illini triumph was scary. Grigori Bjelski, pushed out from his preferred post location by the presence of Cockburn, seemed to force everything through a first-half stalemate, just 11 months after he racked 35 points against these same Scarlet Knights. Nor could his teammates pick him up, as the Illini converted 6 of 31 first-half shots. They had no field goals in the last 7.46 of the half. And then Ron Harper Jr. shot Rutgers ahead 28-22 after the break. Illinois was at that juncture shooting 15% from the field and seemed ready to break the school's 55-year arena low of 23%. To ask for more, for instance, title contention is to overlook how poorly Illinois has shot the basketball for long stretches in this season. Not just misses, but forced attempts and inexplicable airball misfires. In cashing 2 trays out of 14 tries, the Illini fall back to 30%. Marquette, as an example, is one of 6 teams topping 40%. When you've shot 300 three-pointers, as has Illinois, and they compromise 31% of your field goal attempts, it is unlikely success will continue long-term without improvement there. The only way to put points on the board is to make baskets. Close doesn't count. And from Just Askin, has the mansion at Hidden River sold? Not yet. We're still in due diligence. The company is planning to buy the 200-acre lot near Muhammad and split it into 5 to 10-acre lots. The asking price for the 16,000-square-foot Hidden River mansion is $1.9 million, which includes 15 acres of land. The mansion was built in the early 2000s for software developer Bruce Atwood, a University of Illinois graduate and creator of the first consumer flight simulator software. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, January 13th. Please stay tuned.